I get amused at some of the people who react to me on television. You know, God has His own way of taking vengeance. I didn't know, but there was a delegation of preachers within the denomination that I have served as president for years. And what is so amusing is every year, for too many I can't count, Dad, there's been a small handful find something that they would lead a crusade to get rid of me on. The current crusade is my dams and my hells. Preachers just don't use profanity. Which shows how little preachers know about profanity. I mean, if they want me to, I can give them a lesson. Me and Richard Pryor know what profanity is. And it is not dams and hells. You have not even begun until you query into someone's ancestry. Which suggests that God did not order the begetting, which is why it's profanity. But, you know, dams and hells to a few is profanity. If you would ask them in heaven, how come the devil is not here? They would say, he has been D-A-M-N-E-D to H-E-double-L. And I would sidle up to that conversation in heaven also and say, I told you way back there, he's damned to hell. And they will retreat to their little tent and hide, lest they see me the next million years in heaven. But they've been leading a fight. To discipline me. For my dams and my hells. Not getting very far. But I just discovered. I really didn't. I promise you. I knew it. But you know, it's one of those things that shoves out of your mind. Most of those that have led the delegation are in North Carolina. And we're on Channel 40, you know. We're on Channel 40 out of Fayetteville, North Carolina. And, listen, the manager of the station listened to me, and he said, man, he's one hell of a dude. And we said, I can't tell you what we said. But God has His own way of taking vengeance. Now, the other night, about 1 a.m, we got a telephone call. One out of about 500 that were positive said, don't you think preachers shouldn't cuss? Their inability to do it is why we have so few really effective preachers in today's world. Now, there's a difference between profanity and cussing. God never engaged in profanity. He was the sacred himself. Occasionally he cussed the profane. The King James has it cursed. The Selah, think of that. Yet all of these people, what amuses me is these people are willing to make a saint of someone after he's dead. Luther was a cussing machine. And yet all Protestants admire him because he's dead. And I need occasionally to remind these super loving modern Christians whose churches have preachers, I think I'm safe to say, 80% of whom preach from the Calvinist frame. I need to remind them that Calvin burned a guy at the stake. But he's a nice guy now because he's dead. Am I boring you? It's going to be another one of those days I may not preach. And today, everything is family. You know, Christian radio and television stations, so many of them have failed to be effective, they've changed their name. They're now Family. So they can play Leave It to Beaver and Big Valley and occasionally come out and grin at them and say, the Lord, oh God, loves you. Now, I believe in the family. My mother and dad, all these years, remind me of the effectiveness. I believe in the family, but I don't like to create a class of Christian citizenship that beats everybody to death that got tired of paying penance for a 20-year-old mistake. And the good Methodists need to be reminded that Charles Wesley walked in one day, the great songwriter, and found that broad that was married to his brother John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, with tufts of John Wesley's white hair in her fingernails that she had just pulled out as Charles disturbed the fight. You know, there are Methodists that have lived and grown up and are near death in the church. You don't know that. And Wesley wrote his brother Charles. He said, I thank God for the woman God gave me to wed. Because if he had not given her to me, I would have been less faithful to my itinerant ministry. And family counseling and marriage counseling by his brother Charles could not keep John home. Thus, Methodism was born. We may void the Word of God by our damn traditions. A reformation is due in the church. You know that? A brand new reformation. We have no continuing city here. Now, when your glasses are about to fall off and your mustache is in the way, do you have any idea what an eye and a steady hand it takes to find this nose hole? If I didn't have the TV to look at, I could never find it. More evangelical preachers steal Spurgeon's sermons than any other source. If they knew his personal habits, they would excommunicate him. But being poor scholars, they just buy the book of sermons and preach him and forget his habits. And C.S. Lewis, oh, how modern evangelical preachers love to point to him as the bastion of philosophic thought that would hold back the inroads of liberalism that would destroy our faith in Jesus Christ. And they love to quote him out of Mere Christianity. So do I. I like everything about him. And I happen to know his habits. Well, more than anyone else, he laid the foundation for a faith that the choice that Jesus Christ forces upon you, you must accept him for what he claimed to be, the divine Son of God, or consider him as nutty as a man that would consider himself a poached egg. But very few people have read The Pilgrim's Regress. Very few people have seen pictures of C.S. Lewis. I've never seen one of him that he wasn't smoking a pipe. And I'm supposedly, you know, engaging in risque things. God rid it, I didn't. I mean, he didn't have to tell on Abraham. He sure didn't have to tell on Judah. Yet 99 out of 100 of those preachers that make a saint out of C.S. Lewis and Spurgeon, because they're dead, have never read about his autobiographical. He tried to deny it, but it's an autobiographical story. It's really a philosophic furtherance in modern time of John Bunyan's kind of message in The Pilgrim's Progress. This is The Pilgrim's Regress. Every student of C.S. Lewis, those that have read his life stories, know that encased in this little booklet, The Pilgrim's Regress, we don't have it in our bookstore. We'll try to get it. Is his own drift from faith and return. It would literally curl their hair or grow it on their bald heads for some evangelical preachers to know that though this is produced by Erdmann's, a very spiritual publishing house, it's in every Christian bookstore that would never put anything in that Gene Scott wrote because he says damn and hell. Has got John, the hero of the story, most likely identified with C.S. Lewis, fornicating in the woods with a little brown girl. That's what it says. Right here. Very well, thought John, I will enjoy the wood. I will enjoy it. This is in every Christian bookstore of note. I will enjoy it. He set his teeth and wrinkled his forehead and sat. Am I boring you? C.S. Lewis. You know what
Erdmans has to say, the most important Christian writer of our century. You know what's the problem with most preachers? They seldom read the whole of what they steal from. I will enjoy the wood. I will enjoy it. He set his teeth and wrinkled his forehead and sat still until the sweat rolled off him in an effort to enjoy the wood. But the more he tried, the more he felt that there was nothing to enjoy. There was the grass, and there were the trees. But what am I to do with them, said John. Next, it came into his head that he might perhaps get the old feeling for what he thought had to see as a boy. He caught a glimpse. He caught a glimpse of an island, which in this book is the symbol of that eternal desire placed in man, which is the imageness of God in man, that ultimately can only be satisfied by and in relationship to God. And as a boy, I'm going to show you something in a minute. He caught that glimpse, which is one of the reasons why Jesus said, except you become as a child, get some of the casings off that have robbed that searching heart that reaches out for God that too often is killed by the church. But John went looking for his island. It sort of disappeared from his vision. He's in the woods now. He said, what am I to do with them, said John. Next it came into his head he might perhaps get the old feeling. For what, he thought, had the island ever given him but a feeling? You see, Jesus said, no man comes to the Father save the Spirit draw him. That's why I don't try to save people. I can't do it. That's why you can be sure, no matter what anybody tells you, if you want to come to God, you have not committed the unpardonable sin. And that is a feeling. What, he thought, had the island ever given him but a feeling? He shut his eyes and set his teeth again. He made a picture of the island in his mind. But he could not keep his attention on the picture because he wanted all the time to watch some other part of his mind to see if the feeling were beginning. But no feeling began. And then, just as he was opening his eyes, he heard a voice speaking to him. It was quite close at hand and very sweet and not at all like the old voice of the wood. Page 13. When he looked around, he saw what he had never expected. Yet he was not surprised. There in the grass beside him sat a laughing brown girl of about his own age, and she had no clothes on. They would never let me read anything like this in Sunday school. I didn't know you'd find this in a Christian bookstore. There in the glass beside him sat a laughing brown girl of about his own age, and she had no clothes on. And John rose. And caught her all in haste.
Just like a deprived Sunday school kid. And
see you next Sunday.
And committed. Fornication with her in the wood. Ooh. Right here. C.S. Lewis, the most important Christian writer of our century.
You are indeed a lecherous group in need of salvation. Let's get to know this guy, John. You know that this book is written as a dream. C.S. Lewis says, I dreamed of a boy who was born in the land of Puritania. And his name was John. Am I boring you?
No.
Do you have any idea what kind of dreams C.S. Lewis is confessing to? I mean, I know the church, some people grow up in, if you have a dream like that, you won't go to sleep for a week for fear the Lord might come while you're dreaming such a dream. I dreamed you know, most of those owners of bookstores have never read page 13. He does worse, too. I mean, the boy's got a problem. And every bookstore in Southern California and Northern California would be sold out of the Pilgrim's Regress by tomorrow night. You knew you couldn't go into those sex shops, but you can march with your head high into a Christian bookstore.
Let's talk about sin. Come on. Let's talk about sin. Let's talk about sin. I mean, I just haven't figured out what I want to preach yet. Let's go. Let's talk about sin. Go.
Let's talk about sin. Your sin. baby, there is good news. As we fight this thing called sin, if we'll quit trying to do it ourselves, the new man, he will win. God sees the finished product.
Thank you, Sammy. And Ron. And Grant. And Lee. And Dan. You made it through it. I dreamed of a boy who was born in the land of Puritania. And his name was John. And I dreamed that when John was able to walk, he ran out of his parents' garden there in Puritania on a fine morning onto the road. And on the other side of the road, there was a deep wood, but not thick, full of primroses and soft green moss. When John set his eyes on this, this boy thought he had never seen anything so beautiful. He ran across the road and into the wood and was just about to go down on his hands and knees to pull up the primroses by the handfuls when his mother came running out of the garden gate. She also ran across the road and caught John up and smacked him soundly and told him he must never go into the wood again. And John cried. But he asked no questions, for he was not yet at the age for asking questions. Then a year went past. Am I boring you? And then another fine morning, John had a little sling, and he went out into the garden, and he saw a bird sitting on a branch. And John got his sling ready and was going to have a shot at the bird when the cook came running out of the garden and caught John up and smacked him soundly and told him he must never kill any of the birds in the garden. Why? Said John. Because the steward would be very angry, said the cook. Who is the steward? Said John. He is the man who makes rules for all the country around here, said the cook. Why? Said John. Because the landlord set him to do it. Who is the landlord? Said John. The kid was already going to be a problem. Who is the landlord? Said John. He owns all the country, said the cook. Why? Said John. And when he asked this, the cook went and told his mother. And his mother sat down as you no doubt have deduced, I got a runny nose. This makes me sad. And when he asked this, the cook went and told his mother. And his mother sat down and talked to John about the landlord all afternoon. But John took none of it in, for he was not yet at the age for taking it in. Me and John boring you? Then a year went past. Somebody one of these days is going to say yes and we'll throw them out. Then a year went past. And one dark, cold, wet morning, John was made to put on new clothes. I want you to know that what I'm reading you is divine genius incarnately expressed through C.S. Lewis. Not since John Bunyan has a man been able to catch in words the meaning of Christianity and its journey and its foolishness. If he were on TV today, all the pastors would get petitions against him. I don't put myself in C.S. Lewis' class. I'm just saying, if I get petitions, let's read. Then a year went past, and one dark, cold, wet morning, John was made to put on new clothes. They were the ugliest clothes that had ever been put upon him, which John did not mind at all, but they also caught him under the chin and were tied under the arms, which he minded a great deal, and they made him itch all over. And his father and mother took him out along the road, one holding him to each hand, which was uncomfortable too and very unnecessary, and told him they were taking him to see the steward. The steward lived in a big, dark house of stone on the side of the road. The father and mother went in to talk to the steward first, and John was left sitting in the hall on a chair so high that his feet did not reach the floor. Any of you ever remember your first trip to church? There were other chairs in the hall where he could have sat in comfort, but his father had told him that the steward would be very angry. He didn't sit absolutely still and be very good. And John was beginning to be afraid, so he sat still in the high chair with his feet dangling and his clothes itching all over him and his eyes starting out of his head. After a very long time, his parents came back again, looking as if they'd been with the doctor. Very grave. Then they said that John must go in and see the steward too. I'm boring you. And when John came into the room, there was an old man with a red round face who was very kind and full of jokes. So that John quite got over his fears and had a good talk about fishing tackle and bicycles. But just when the talk was at its best, the steward got up and cleared his throat. He then took down a mask from the wall with a long white beard attached to it and suddenly clapped it on his face so that his appearance was awful. And he said, "Now I'm going to talk to you about the landlord. The landlord owns all the country. And it is very, very kind of him to allow us to live on it at all. Very, very kind." He went on repeating, "Very kind," in a queer sing-song voice, so long that John would have laughed, but now that he was beginning to get frightened again. The steward then took down from a peg
a big card with small print over all of it and said, "Here is a list of all the things the landlord says you must not do. You better look at it." So John took the card. But half the rules seemed to forbid things he'd never heard of. And the other half forbade things he was doing every day and could not imagine not doing. And the number of the rules was so enormous that he felt he could never remember them all. "I hope," said the steward, wearing his mask, "I hope that you have not already broken any of the rules." John's heart began to thump, and his eyes bulged more and more, and he was at his wit's end. When the steward took the mask off and looked at John with his real face and said, "Better tell a lie, old chap, better tell a lie. Easiest for all concerned," and popped the mask on his face all in a flash. "Better tell a lie, old chap. It's easiest for all concerned. Here's your card. Sunday morning preacher. When you really get the truth." You see, the steward knew John would not tell Mom and Dad. He had to wear the mask for his knowledgeable parishioners. John gulped and said quickly, "Oh, no, sir." "That's just as well," said the steward through the mask, "because, you know, if you did break any of them and the landlord got to know of it, do you know what he'd do to you?" "No, sir," said John. And the steward's eyes seemed to be twinkling dreadfully through the holes of the mask. "He'd take you and shut you up forever and ever in a black hole full of snakes and scorpions as large as lobsters forever and ever." "Besides that, he is such a kind, good man, so very, very kind, that I'm sure you would never want to displease him." "No, sir," said John. "No, sir. But please, sir." "Well," said the steward, "please, sir, supposing I did break one little one just by accident, you know, could nothing stop the snakes and lobsters?" "Ah," said the steward. And then he sat down and talked for a long time, but John could not understand a single syllable. However, it all ended with pointing out that the landlord was quite extraordinarily kind and good to his tenants and would certainly torture most of them to death the moment he had the slightest pretext. "And you can't blame him," said the steward, mask on, "for after all, it is his land and it is so very good of him to let us live here at all, people like us, you know." Am I boring you? This is my introduction. I have a message, I really do. Then the steward took off his mask and had a nice, sensible chat with John again and gave him a cake and brought him out to his father and mother. And just as they were going, he bent down and whispered in John's ear. I shouldn't bother about it all too much if I were you. At the same time, he slipped the card of rules into John's hand and told him he could keep it for his own use. Sing I've Had It, will you, right now? Just listen to this song.
I've had it with friends and family who think they are examples of Christianity. For years they found my freedom and took my liberty. No more can say who do me, cause Jesus cut me free. Yeah, I've had it. In the name of love, my spirit has been slain by good-intentioned people with ignoramus brains who place themselves as judge with mercy out of view and think they're on the list of Jehovah's chosen few. I've had it with friends and family who think they are examples of Christianity. For years they found my freedom and took my liberty. No more can they who do me, cause Jesus cut me free. Yeah, I've had it. They told me shave that beard, such evil I'm a shun, and stay away from places where normal folk have fun. Separate yourself now and be a good church mouse, cause flames of hell will get you if you're in that movie house. I've had it with friends and family who think they are examples of Christianity. For years they found my freedom and took my liberty. No more can they who do me, cause Jesus cut me free. Yeah, I've had it. They made me burn my records, my pool stick, and my cards. To eat was all that's left to do, and I got fat as lard. Thank God I got delivered and finally saw the light. The hell with man-made versions of what is wrong and right. Oh, I've had it with friends and family who think they are examples of Christianity. For years they found my freedom and took my liberty. No more can they who do me, cause Jesus cut me free. I've had it with friends and family who think they are examples of Christianity. For years they found my freedom and took my liberty. No more can they who do me, cause Jesus cut me free. Yeah, I've had it. I've had it.
I want to put another little building block in the introduction for the message that will be right to the point. You see, I would lose my sanity in the modern church world if I did not have access to the truth of history of the men that have shaped God's church in contrast to the self-perpetuating image makers that have undone, usually in one generation, what the real men of God have done to the church world. You only have to read the New Testament. Paul wrote the Ephesians, and they were seated in heavenly places in Christ Jesus, the habitation of God through the Spirit. 30 years later, John writes the same church and says, you've lost your first love. Only took 30 years. To substitute performance of man for the vitality and reality of the relationship.
God has called this church with its pastor to a mission. And as I said, the church needs a reformation. Protestants need to protest what's going on in the name of Christ. It's easy to forget the pressure on Martin Luther. The whole church world was complacent, and everybody was in agreement, and he was a disturber as he brought reformation. As now, Satan's tactic as an angel of light is to say, everybody get along now, because I'm seated. In the establishment. It is Satan's tactic to lay on man perfectionism. The idea of Peter at the gate judging you by what you did in this life is a Babylonian heathen concept. It is straight from the mouth of Satan. You can get in by being a good man. No, you can't. The best man in the world can't make it. Now, it's very easy to preach the gospel of Christ on foreign soil because they have been under the whip of Satan. When you belittle heathen doctrines, don't forget that every heathen religion starts with a premise that they must achieve within that frame to be accepted by their view of the deity. It is a religion of works wherever you turn. And you come as an ambassador of Christ and you say, whom the Son sets free is free indeed. And you deliver them from the yoke of that evil bondage into the freedom that is in God and the grace of unmerited favor. But in America, that heathen concept has had Christ stamped on it. Until the oppressor is the church and Christ distorted through tradition. Until the surgery of America is the same kind of surgery that Luther had to perform on the church, having sought his redemption in every work, finally standing to his feet with knees bloodied from crawling up that step of the Lateran Palace in Rome. The words of a simple monk, written four times, three in the New Testament, one in the Old Testament, rang out of his inner heart of memory, and he burst it forth from his lips, "The just shall live by faith," and the Reformation was born. The traditions of men have been putting works back in its place. I'm going to finish the introduction because this is where American Christianity begins. Now the days and the weeks went on again, and I dreamed that John had little peace, either by day or night, for thinking of the rules and the black hole full of snakes. At first, he tried very hard to keep them all. But when it came to bedtime, he always found he'd broken four more than he'd kept. And the thought of the horrible tortures to which the good, kind landlord would put him became such a burden that next day he would become quite reckless and break as many as he possibly could. For oddly enough, this eased his mind for a moment. Selah. And then after a few days, the fear would return. This time it'd be worse than before because of the dreadful number of rules that he had broken during the interval. But what puzzled him most at this time was a discovery which he made after the rules had been hanging in his bedroom for two or three nights. Namely, that on the other side of the card, on the backs, there was a quite different set of rules. There were so many, he never read them all through, and he was always finding new ones. Some of them were very like the rules on the front of the card, but most of them were just the opposite. You know, Philippines, the dress low on the top. Hong Kong, Calcutta. Thus, whereas the front of the card said you must be always examining yourself to see how many rules you've broken, the back of the card said something different. Whereas the front said, the back said, and so on. Now I dreamed that John went out one morning, tried to play in the road and forget his troubles. But the rules kept coming back into his head, so that he did not make much of it. However, he went on always a few yards further, till suddenly he looked up and saw that he was so far away from home that he was in a part of the road he had never seen before. Then came the sound of a musical instrument. From behind it seemed, very sweet and very short, as if it were one plucking of a string or one note of a bell, and after it a full, clear voice. And it sounded so high and strange that he thought it was very far away, further than a star. The voice said, "Come." Then John saw that there was a stone wall beside the road in that part. But it had had what he had never seen in the garden wall before, a window. There was no glass in the window and no bars. It was just a square hole in the wall. Through it he saw a green wood full of primroses. And he remembered suddenly how he had gone into another wood to pull primroses as a child very long ago, so long that even in the moment of remembering, the memory seemed still out of reach. While he strained to grasp it, there came to him from beyond the wood a sweetness. You see, there are people that have been driven to confusion and driven out by the rules. But they remember something, that tug of the Spirit that keeps them uncomfortable in rejecting God. Where John is. I shouldn't interpret it to you. You're smart enough to figure it yourself. But there may be some of my critics listening. While he strained to grasp it, there came to him from beyond the wood a sweetness and a pang so piercing that instantly he forgot his father's house and his mother and the fear of the landlord and the burden of the rules. All the furniture of his mind was taken away. A moment later he found that he was sobbing and the sun had gone in. And what it was that had happened to him he could not quite remember, nor whether it had happened in this wood or in the other wood when he was a child. It seemed to him that a mist which hung at the far end of the wood had parted for a moment, and through the rift he had seen a calm sea, and in the sea an island where the smooth turf sloped down unbroken to the bays, and out of the thickets peeped the pale, small-breasted oreads, wise like gods, unconscious of themselves like beasts, tall enchanters, bearded to their feet, sat in green chairs among the forest. And even while he pictured these things, he knew with one part of his mind that they were not like the things he had seen, nay, that what had befallen him was not seeing at all, but he was too young to heed the distinction, and too empty now that the unbounded sweetness passed away not to seize greedily whatever it had left behind. He had no inclination yet to go into the wood, and presently went home with a sad excitement upon him, repeating to himself 1,000 times, "I know now what I want." The first time that he said it, he was aware that it wasn't entirely true, but before he went to bed, he was believing it. Now, John had a disreputable old uncle who was the tenant of a poor little farm beside his father's. And I'll stop right there. You can read the book if you want. It's a pretty good one of John's journey. That island, that glimpse, that something, that drawing of the Spirit, that the card of rules and the mask of the representative and the false presentations of the landlord had killed or dimmed. It's that little flame that I want to fan alive. And this morning I want you to turn to Romans chapter 3.
As you figured out, we're on basic Christianity today. Paul spent two chapters leading up to the third. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. None that doeth good. No, not one. He's not going to make a distinction before God between the heathen and the Jew. The Jew has received the revelation of a rule card that God wrote. The heathen without it, some of them, because of something written in their conscience, outperform them. Doesn't matter. All have sinned. Hang the rule card up. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. There's none that doeth good, no, not one. Therefore, verse 20, by the deeds of the law there shall no flesh, the Greek has it, not any exceptions anywhere. No flesh be justified in his sight. 23rd verse, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Being justified. Am I boring you? Being justified. Now, what does that word justified mean? In simple terms, it means you are taken as though you are just like. It is not an existential change. You haven't changed a quarter turn. The rules are still on the card on the wall. The fears are still within. At that moment, your behavior still falls short. Got that? No possible question. Get Ethel a glass of water. And don't worry about Ethel. Sometimes Ethel's afraid to slip out because she's up here. Get her a glass of water. But I'm right down to the message. And why should she fight the cough? The rest of you that are closer to a fountain, let them move, ushers. Everything is prepared for this moment. You haven't changed a quarter turn. To be justified is to be taken as though you're just like, even though you're not. Justification is totally an external happening done by another that takes you as though you are just like God, though you are not. You have fallen short. You haven't made it. All have sinned. Hamartia is the word in the Greek. Come short of. And you've come short of the glory of God. Being an ongoing happening. It continues to happen. Being taken as just like God freely. By His grace, God's grace, unmerited favor, charisma, through the redemption, price paying, taken just like God, freely, unmerited favor, grace, through the redemption, price paying, and full price paying. Because a price was paid for this shortfalling one, God will take you as though you're just like God freely as unmerited favor. Through the price paying that is in Christ Jesus, whom God, the landlord, not properly characterized, by the way, by too many stewards, whom God hath set forth to be a propitiation through faith in His blood
to declare his righteousness for the remission or passing over of sins that are passed through the forbearance of God. That's a long $75 theological clause. Propitiation is the paying of the price. The propitiatory is the evidencing that the price is paid. The act of payment is the propitiation. The propitiatory is the stamp receipt, paid in full. The word ought to be propitiatory. The Greek is speaking of the distinction between the offering of the sacrifice in the outer court of the Old Testament and the carrying of the blood into the inner court, which is the symbol of heaven, and into the Holy of Holies, real heaven before God, where it is accepted. If it weren't accepted, the priest would drop dead and the bells on the bottom of his robe would stop ringing and the people would know the sacrifice was inadequate. What God is saying here through Paul is that God has accepted. The propitiatory is accepted, and payment in full has been evidenced. Every sin of every man, every age, every place, every time, every item. It's passed over because it's covered. Because Christ is the propitiatory. Therefore, verse 28, we conclude that a man is justified, being held as just like God, not because he is, but because he has faith, which is a different kind of action, an acting on the promises of God, and because of that faith, God stamps on him, takes out of the receipt, paid in full. You get the benefit of what's already been paid for. Take it, put it in your bag, and go home. You're covered. You are saved. Oh, I can't be. Because I remember old Brother Stewart. I watched him as a boy get fatter every month as he sat in his righteousness on the platform of my church. He was always present when we drove somebody out for breaking the rules. Brother Stewart never ever said damn. He never ever said hell. He wouldn't even go to the woods. He wouldn't know what to do if he got there. I'm telling you, it can't be that easy. It wasn't, my friend. It was obtained very hard through the redemption that Christ paid. And because of his Son, God gives salvation for different reasons. You can make it to that island, friend. And when your lease is up down here, you can live in the castle with the landlord, and you don't go to the snake pit, and he's been falsely characterized because it was simply not possible to keep the rules. The landlord's son did it for us, removed them, covered us, and we make it on a different basis. Well, what should we say then? That Abraham, super steward, our father, has pertaining to the flesh, hath found. If Abraham were justified by works, if he became just like God by actually accomplishing it with his works, he hath whereof to glory. but not before God. For what saith the Scripture? Abraham faith God, literally, and that, the faith, was counted unto him for righteousness. Not his performance, his faith. Now to him that worketh, if you want to be just like God by your ability, oh, a man of God gets to heaven by not saying dom and hell. I mean, D-A-M-N and H-E-double-L. Now, obviously, I'm using myself ludicrously. You make the application to yourself. A man of God would never do that. Now, to him that worketh, is the reward not reckoned of grace, unmerited favor, but of debt. My lease is up. I stand before the landlord. I thank my God. Dear sir, I will never have my righteous ears hurt by a D-A-M-N or an H-E-double-L. Only the snakes in the black hole will hear it from now on. I have earned a key room with a view in your castle. Take me in. In fact, maybe you would like me to stand at the gate a while so that the people down there getting close can see what it takes to get in. I want my reward. You've heard me say this before. Go to hell. Go to hell. You really want to get in, do you? By eliminating the damn in hell. Well, you eliminated it from your vocabulary. You got it for the rest of eternity. That ain't the way you get in. Now to him that worketh is the reward, not reckoned of unmerited favor, but of debt. You owe me, God. So many times I wanted to cuss Scott, and I didn't. So many times I wanted to damn him, and I didn't. You owe me heaven, Lord. You might as well accost him. And Scott's coming prancing by saying, how the hell are you? And the intensity of the moment breaks the old deacon down. Or preacher. Breaks that non-cussing preacher down. And after all this, thinking he was rid of me, and I go marching by, how in the hell are you? He says, I'll be damned. And he will be. To him that worketh is the reward not reckoned of unmerited favor, but of debt. God, I don't want to feel like I don't deserve heaven. I mean, I've worked 40 years. I'd rather live in a cabin in the corner of Glory Land and say, I did it, by dammy. Only one guy gets credit up here. And there's only one way in. Faith in him. Because you see, God wants to give it away to whom he will. And he's going to give it to people that trust him. But to him that worketh not, you know what that says in the Greek? You don't do
a damn diddly do thing. Nothing. To him that doesn't do anything. You mean I don't have to read the card every morning? Nope. I get up in the morning and see what is coming down on me that is ridden on by Satan on a surfboard, and Satan is saying, God's not alive. He doesn't know where you're at. He doesn't care about you. He isn't looking out for you. You're out of his will. That's when you can say, damn you, devil. Forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven. You can grab hold of a promise. And that gutsy action of taking God's word and staring every circumstance in the teeth. God says, I'm going to cover him. To him that worketh not. The context is works of the law. To him that isn't trying in his own energy to be like God. I believe God can forgive my past sins when I was ignorant. But not anymore. I mean, I'd better work my day damned asteroid off to be like him. Sorry. To him that worketh not, but believeth on him that justifieth the better than average, at least. Is that what it says? To him that justifies those that are just a little bit better. To him, wait a minute. But to him that worketh not, but faitheth on him that justifieth good men, good women, pretty good men. I don't like pretty men. Pretty women. Somebody said yes. But to him that worketh not, but faitheth on him that treats as though they're just like God, who? The ungodly. Boy, we got a crowd full of them here. A whole crowd full of them here. Starting right here. The ungodly. How's God do that? He justifies. He takes as just like God. The ungodly. Well, now, wait a minute. That's okay. He can do it. But he's only going to take the ones that are 90% godly. Justifieth those that have no godliness in them at all. How? His faith. Just a simple exchange. His faith is taken as though it were righteousness. Simple as that. You know why God's changing lives everywhere the message is going? People that saw the island and had it beat out of them are beginning to understand the weight of that island is faith, not a set of rules. And you've grabbed hold of an opportunity that's God-given that we might fade together to protest and to reform this church that's departed from the bases of salvation. And by this church, I mean the whole world of it. I don't like it. It's the last song. I'll finish my message next Sunday.